Welcome to the Dads and Stats podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Vicky. You might notice the new name of the podcast. I decided to change it from PyData Deep Dive because I want the name to reflect the broadened scope, which includes data science, entrepreneurship, open source, and much more. Today's episode is actually a great example of that. My guest is no other than Kevin Systrom, the co-founder and former CEO of Instagram. In this episode, we talk about his time after leaving the company, whether becoming a billionaire has made him happier, and what role meditation plays in his life. We then dive into his current project, which is called RT.live, a website that tracks the spread of COVID-19. We talk about why he chose a Bayesian approach to estimate the spread characteristics, why he picked PyMC3, what his learning experience was like, and what resources he recommends to other newcomers to probabilistic programming. One of the things that Kevin mentions is the lack of good teaching materials for Bayesian statistics and probabilistic programming. Partly inspired by this, I'm currently in the process of creating an online course called An Intuitive Guide to Bayesian Statistics, which focuses on building strong intuitions using visualizations and code rather than being overly math-heavy. You can find out more by visiting twiki.io, that's T-W-I-E-C-K-I, and clicking on Intuitive Bayesian Course. Now, without further delay, I bring you Kevin Systrom. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Kevin.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, and thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So you are the co-founder and former CEO of the somewhat well-known company called Instagram. And while that is super interesting, it's not what I want to focus on today. If listeners are interested in that, there are countless interviews, articles, podcasts, books to learn about all that. Instead, what I want to focus on here is what you have been up to since leaving the company, which was, I think, in 2018. So maybe you can take us back to what your life and mindset was like immediately after having left Instagram.
I'm laughing only because you're asking me to relive a pretty tumultuous moment in life, but I can do that. So starting Instagram, first of all, was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life, and getting to run it and being able to work with the team that we had assembled was also one of the most rewarding experiences I could have had, not just professionally, but in life, to watch something grow from two people working effectively a garage, right? And to watch it reach over a billion people at the end was, you can't replicate that experience very easily. Let's just put it that way. So deciding to leave, the way I explained it to a lot of people is that you have different chapters in your life. And if your life is like a book, you have different chapters. And inevitably, chapters open and they close. You know, I have two kids now. That's a new chapter. I got married when I was at Instagram. That was a new chapter. But at some point, I knew, because we had sold the company and it was part of Facebook, that my heart was in doing something new eventually. And that chapter came towards the, I guess it would have been end of 2018. And when I left, it's kind of like jumping into a really cold ocean, right? Like you're both free and exhilarated to do lots of stuff, but it's also like, what do you have to hang on to? Because your day to day beforehand was so structured. You know, you had staff meetings, you had an assistant with a calendar, and you had everything perfectly mapped out. And then all of a sudden you were free. So it's a bit of a blank canvas. Yeah. But what I did was I said to myself, I was going to use that time to reset and focus on something new or some things that were new. And not necessarily a new company, but rather life. Number one, I focused on being a good dad. So our daughter had been born a handful of months before I left. And being able to be around as she learned to talk, as she learned to walk, was a really incredible experience. Number two, I wanted to find a hobby or find something on my bucket list that required a lot of work, a lot of mental work, but wasn't related to Silicon Valley and wasn't related to tech. And I looked at I have this thing called a someday maybe list. And the someday maybe list is just a list of things that I might someday maybe want to do. And I looked at it and it said flying lessons. I was like, you know what? I've always really wanted to learn to fly. So why don't I dive in on that? It'll keep my brain busy and sharp because every pilot I know is super sharp and detail-oriented and methodical. And so I started that just by taking a few lessons and realized that I loved to fly and that it was going to be something that took my mind off Silicon Valley and technology for a little while, but while remaining sharp and agile in a way that you're required to do in order to stay alive. So in the months after I left, that's basically what I focused on doing and ended up getting my license and my instrument rating fairly quickly. And that remains a hobby today. But I guess in summary, what I'll say is it was a great opportunity to like challenge your mind in a very different and new way. And anyone who knows me knows the number one thing I love to do in life is learn and do new things. So this was just on that list. And that's how I spent the first few months after Instagram.
That's really interesting. Yeah. So it's really interesting to hear you talk more about the personal aspect as well. And that's something I want to explore a little bit more of. So obviously selling Instagram has made you quite wealthy. And it's not too often that I have a billionaire on my podcast. So I'd be curious to hear what impact that had on your life and lifestyle. And also particularly whether you felt that it had any lasting impact on your overall happiness.
Well, first I'll say in Silicon Valley, there are different stories of people making money, losing money, then making money again, right? But I think that misses a bit of the point, which is that the money is not the thing that ends up making you happy. It's not the thing that fills you with pride or fills you with fulfillment, right? Instead, what fills you with pride and fulfillment is starting something that people love. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about my current project a little bit later, but I was mentioning to someone yesterday, we had been working on the site RT Live now for a few months, and how meaningful it was to me that pretty influential people found it very useful for their work. And it didn't need to scale to a billion people to make me happy, right? Like it didn't, like the best thing as an entrepreneur is to create something that people find useful. I mean, you've been working on this library, PyMC3, for a while, and I can only imagine how it feels when scientists that you really respect or entrepreneurs use it to do something new and unexpected. So the money side of things, I think it's a bit of a red herring. It's misleading, right? Mm-hmm. It makes you think that that's going to be the thing that ends up making you feel great. But the thing that actually makes you feel great is when people use your product. And it turns out they're correlated, right? The more people that use your product, mm-hmm. often the more money you can make off an opportunity. But just backing up a little bit to talk maybe about wealth more generally, all wealth does is allow you to buy time. And time is the one finite thing in all of our lives. I have 24 hours in the day. You do too. Everyone does. And what capital allows you to do is leverage that time. So it allows you to hire people to work on things so that you can scale your time and your vision. So if you want to build something, you can just hire a team to do it. And then therefore, your 1 hour of work turns into, I don't know, 10 or 12 hours of work. So that's the way I think about capital. And in that framing, capital makes me very happy because I can then go and build new things. And at the end of the day, that's, I think, the most fulfilling part of being an entrepreneur.
So, and then I wonder, is there any startup entrepreneurial advice in that where you're saying, well, it's actually much more about having a positive impact on lives of people rather than the wealth? Do you think that that is a better thing to think about when founding a new company?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this a little bit. Like, there are people who get tremendously wealthy by investing in companies, but not actually working on the company. And I'm not actually going to place judgment on that at all, because, you know, that's one way of making money. And that's why people invest, right? However, in deciding what my next chapter would be, I often considered, do I want to spend time investing or do I want to spend time building? And what I realized time and time again was that if I build something, I get tremendous satisfaction out of getting it right and having people love it, right? Whereas investing, if I just turn, you know, $100 into $1,000, like that's not nearly as satisfying. So wouldn't you rather turn $100 into $1,000 and make people happy? Totally, at least in my mind, right? So I guess the lesson in entrepreneurship is there's no there in the money. There's there in creating something amazing for people. And the money typically follows that, but doesn't necessarily have to if that's not your primary aim. That's the entrepreneurship lesson that I take away from my experience, at least.
That's interesting, yeah. And then also just in terms of motivation and happiness, you and I recently talked about meditation, which I'm personally a huge fan of. How did you come to that, and what benefit does it provide to you?
This is a funny story. Okay, so first off, my first foray into meditation was while I was working at Instagram. I would have, it was about an hour or so commute to work. And, you know, Facebook has these buses and people get rides to work. So like you have a long time to kill in traffic. And I was talking with a bunch of friends about how we would spend that time. And I suggested that people pick up meditation. I can't remember what got me into it, but I tried the app Headspace and I just found it to be completely freeing. Like I would go from being really stressed about something to feeling still stressed about it, but much more level-headed, right? Much more just stable, I guess would be the word. So a bunch of people tried it and said they loved it too. And it always kind of kept in the back of my mind, but I didn't keep up with it nearly as well as I should have. But what's really interesting is I met a guy, his name is Ray Dalio. He's the founder of a hedge fund called Bridgewater. They've done phenomenally well over the last, I don't know, 30 or 40 years. And he wrote this book called Principles. And I happened to run into him at an event. We were just chatting. And through our chat, we talked a bunch about his lessons he had learned throughout his life. And the one thing he kept saying to me was like, listen, you're doing everything right. But the one thing that I keep hearing you're missing is the meditation. And he said, I've been meditating for my entire life. And it's helped me tremendously to basically build the things that I built. You really need to look into this. So about 3 months ago, I started trying in earnest to meditate roughly twice a day. I love how I say in earnest roughly. Basically trying to do it twice a day. And I usually get to it like one and a half times a day on average throughout the week. But what I find is it helps you, it's kind of like resorting your brain or defragging your brain, right? Like everything's scattered. And what it allows you to do is basically take a back seat and let your brain kind of relax and unwind a little bit so that you have more energy when you're facing the challenges that you do face. Maybe as a last story on this, I'll say I'm also a cyclist, an avid cyclist, or at least I'm trying to get back into it. And one of the most important things you can do to get better at cycling is rest. Far too many people do enormous workouts every single day. And then they're surprised 2 weeks in when they're completely burned out. And what I learned from some coaches that have coached some of the best cyclists in the world is it's really important to find your rest days and time them correctly. So I think of meditation as almost like a resting 20 minutes during the day just to give your brain that chance to relax and unwind so that when you do tackle the problems you're going to tackle that are inevitably going to be very hard, that you're ready to do them.
Yeah, I really like the metaphor you used with defragging the mind. And definitely it has that effect on me. The other metaphor I like to use is it also just daily mindfulness provides you with a great debugger for your mind. So by just observing the mind do its thing, you see like all these bugs in it and like, oh, well, why is that thing coming up again? Like that doesn't make any sense. And that way just like sort of work out the kinks over time.
By the way, I feel like my biggest challenge with meditation is not thinking too much while I meditate because my mind likes to race. And that is the biggest challenge, I think, for most beginning meditators is to clear the space in the mind to actually have some quiet time. But I guess I'm mentioning this just because I think a lot of people think that meditation is easy, but I find it very difficult. It's like an active calm, right? Like it takes a lot of energy sometimes to be restful.
It really does, yeah. And that is the first lesson I think that most people come away with, is that you think like, oh, okay, well, I'll just sit there and don't have to do anything. That's so easy. But then you find out like, oh, that's actually the hardest thing out there, is to not think constantly. And with practice, getting better able to do that is like the best resting place you can imagine.
Exactly. So for those who are interested in meditation, I found the Headspace app to be very helpful to get started. Though it's good for, I think, beginners, and I think it's good for a certain type of meditation. I've never tried Calm, but that's another app that a lot of people use. I started reading The Mind Illuminated, which I find so far to be a very like solid intro to general meditation practice without saying like you must do it X, Y, or Z way. So those are the resources I'd point people at if they're interested in meditation. I'm not sure if you have your own.
Right. Yeah, actually, The Mind Illuminated is also my biggest recommendation. It's a very methodological introduction that I think actually a lot of people I meet in the meditation space are engineers, and they use that same book just because of it's like basically has these 10 different stages and you move up the stages. So this sort of gamification, I think, speaks to a lot of minds of our profession.
Right.
So having dug into your motivations and drives, I wonder how this relates to your current project, which is RT.live, which is also how you and I met. Could you let us know what RT.live is and what motivated you to build it?
Sure. Well, first I want to clarify something, which is I think we did meet because of RT Live, but also I had just become so interested and fascinated with Bayesian statistics after reading a book called Bayesian Methods for Hackers. And by the way, the title sounds a lot cheesier than the book is. Like the book's actually fantastically written and really interesting examples. But I am not a hacker, nor do I claim to be any related to that activity, but rather I was really interested in Bayesian statistics. So anyway, I reached out through some friends because I'm also interested in quantitative finance and you were working at Quantopian. So that's how we initially got started. And the first version of RT Live, or at least what would become RT Live, actually didn't use PyMC3 at all, but rather, it used some form of Bayesian statistics, but it was very, very light. So for those that don't know, RT.live is effectively just a UI on top of a model that I built to track the spread of the coronavirus state by state in the United States. And RT is a metric, R sub T is a metric called the effective reproduction ratio. And it sounds complicated, but it's actually quite simple. It's literally just the number of people who get sick because one other person is sick. So Thomas, if you were sick and you gave it to three other people during the course of your infection, and you were the only person sick in the world, RT would be 3. And the idea there is that it's a multiplier that effectively tells you how quickly the virus is spreading or how effectively it's spreading. And as I looked around, there was really no great resource to understand what RT was. And through a lot of hard work and a lot of debugging, me and this other guy, Tom Vladek, were able to come up with a model that basically it tracks RT on a daily basis, effectively recreates the RT curve on a daily basis since coronavirus started. And the issue is models are great, except when no one looks at them. So we decided we would make a UI. My co-founder, Mike from Instagram, is really talented at UI and graphing and data visualization. So he took that on, I took the model on, and then we now present those findings. Basically, every morning the model runs at something like 2 or 3 a.m. and then we check the numbers and then we publish them in the morning, and people have really caught on. So they are able now to see how quickly it's spreading state by state. And to close this thought, I'll also say the only reason we built this was because we thought that this wasn't going to be a one and done situation where coronavirus hits, it peaks, and then it goes away. It was clear to us that both the combination of the political situation in the United States, the policy situation, and frankly, just the cultural situation in the United States would combine to mean that we'd need to be able to track this on an ongoing basis, because it wasn't going to be something that just peaked and went away like it has in a lot of parts of the world. we'd need to know what was happening in real time. So we created the site as effectively a public service, and I thought it was going to be a side project, and it has become a 16 to 18 hour each day marathon.
Jesus.
As Thomas, you've probably seen it as you've been watching a little bit as well. But it's super exciting and it feels good. You know, it's funny. Someone wrote in from one of the competitors we had at Instagram. I'm not going to name names or anything, but just said, hey, like, you know, it's really interesting to see you go on to this new chapter. And I said, well, this may not be as big as Instagram, but that's not the goal. The goal is to be super useful to people in the world. And there are only so many filters you can make before you decide you want to go and give differently to the world. And we both had a little laugh over that. So sure. I'm pretty happy with the result. It's taken a lot of work to get it to where it is, but I'm very, very happy.
And you sort of alluded to that there is some similarity in the motivation between Instagram and RT.live, which is to have an impact, a positive impact on people's lives. Is there anything else that feels similar about this?
So what I'd say, if I were to look at the things that I work on, you draw a Venn diagram of what do you find super interesting in the world? What do you intellectually curious about? Like, what questions do you have? So for instance, I had a question about how quickly the virus was spreading and I couldn't answer that, right? So that's one circle, is just intellectual curiosity. The second circle is, what do you want to learn? What skills do you want to build? I don't think anyone ever picked up pro basketball, like who plays pro basketball or football or whatever, without saying, I really want to get good at this game, right? Like, I want to learn how to pass, or I want to learn how to shoot a three-pointer or dunk or whatever, right? Like, these are all skills that you're like, ooh, not only am I intellectually dissatisfied with the lack of answers out in the world, but also I really want to learn how to do this, right? So that's the other circle. And then I guess probably other circles, but the last big circle of the Venn diagram is, how much does the world need this, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be intellectually curious in something, feel like you don't have the answer yourself, but like the world doesn't care, and then it doesn't become an opportunity. But if the world cares, in which case, like, I think RT is a good example of the world caring, or at least becoming more and more caring by the day as they start to see that this isn't going away. Then you have a really interesting intersection where you have, you're both solving your own problem, which is, wow, you get to learn something new. You get to answer your own question. And by the way, lots of other people have this problem too and want to answer this question. So Instagram was the same thing. I was super interested in photography. I really wanted to build something on mobile because, remember, back in 2010, mobile wasn't like as big as it is now, where it's kind of the default. And photography, at least on mobile, wasn't beautiful. It was kind of blurry and low quality. And we wanted to be the first ones to really unlock sharing on mobile as it relates to photography. So we also solved a problem that a lot of people had, which was they wanted to do that too. So those three circles in the Venn diagram, I think, are extremely important when deciding what I want to do. Now, you may have different circles, right? Like, you may have a different rubric by which you grade or assess opportunities. But those are my main components, and they've served me well so far.
That really reminds me of the concept of ikigai, which is a Japanese word meaning reason for being. Hmm. Essentially, that's the intersection between the Venn diagram of what you love, what you're good at. I guess that's also related to what you want to be good at, what the world needs, and then finally also what you can get paid for. So if you can get all those four things overlapping, then you have ikigai.
Right. And so that's interesting. I didn't realize there was that concept, but I had been introduced to effectively these circles back in college. And the last one really was like what the world will pay you to do. And I guess I left that one out because I feel like I've been so lucky with Instagram that I don't really, like, this project isn't about making money for me. And I've been lucky enough that it doesn't have to be. But I would agree that that circle is very important when considering what you're doing. But I would almost say it's less about making money, because that's almost a shortcut for saying, get what you want out of life. Like if you want to send your kids to an Ivy League school, it costs a certain amount, right? Like if you want to live in a city versus a rural town, like that costs a certain amount. So designing your life and understanding what you want out of it and then mapping your profession to get what you want out of life, I think is an important principle.
Hmm. So what do you think is the maximum impact that RT.live could have in an ideal scenario?
So what's interesting is I'm relearning a bunch of lessons that I had to learn in a pretty hard way at Instagram, which was early on, most people doubt you and most people think something's worthless, right? And you kind of question whether or not you should work on it too, right?
Right.
And also the first version of something is usually pretty terrible. And if you go onto my blog, you can see the first version of tracking RT and it's not actually terrible. And I think a lot of people really liked it, but it's far from accurate compared to what we have today. So the other lesson is like the longer you work on something, the better it's going to get. You just have to put hours in, but there are going to be lots of dissenting voices along the way. And then, you know, what's also interesting is having founded Instagram, anything that I do often gets a big kind of spotlight the first couple days, and then it falls off because it had a spotlight for a couple of days. And now it's like, okay, show up. Are you useful or not? Right. But what's interesting is that I think the energy of a lot of people who either want to work on something or usually comes from them looking around the world and saying, is this thing exciting or not? Like, are people excited about this? And what a lot of people don't realize is that it takes a really long time to get to that point. You just have to keep pushing. So the 50 or 60 concurrent users we had early on blossomed into 200 or 300, blossomed into nearly 1,000 yesterday, right? So it's not huge like Instagram, but it's certainly growing. I mean, when you have somewhere on the order of like 50, 60, 70,000 people visiting something every day to figure out a single statistic, that's pretty exciting. And you're only 2 months in, really in earnest in development. You haven't really launched it in the way, like you haven't publicized it. Or so I'm excited to see what happens over the next few months. But what I'll also say, it's the one company or project I hope becomes obsolete very quickly. Like it would be great if RT Live went away because the coronavirus went away. But given that I don't think it's going away, I think it's important to keep pushing. But one of the lessons that I've learned is just, it's not big until it's big. So you kind of have to believe it's going to be big and push on it and push on it, push on it and grow and see that improvement every day. And then people start to come around and get excited about it.
How specifically do you think it'll help us get through the pandemic? Like, are these maybe government agencies looking at this, or is it the target audience is individuals who might influence their decisions of whether to engage in certain activities?
Well, I've always been concerned that people will, what I would call, over-rotate on a single piece of data like RT Live. I would like to be one of many tools people go to triangulate and understand what they should and shouldn't do, or how things are going, because there are lots of views or lenses on the current situation. So I'll say that starting off, someone wrote in to our help email address this morning, hey, like, is it okay? Like, I'm a pregnant woman and I want to fly to Detroit. Am I safe on a plane? And I responded like, please go check with your doctor, right? Like, we are not here to make prescriptions of whether or not people are safe, right? So that's the first thing I'll say. The second thing I'll say is, interestingly, decided early on to not focus on what everyone else was focusing on, which was to try to predict the future. I believe predicting the future in a case like this is very difficult to do because humans aren't static. We don't just let things happen. The worse the pandemic gets, the more conservative we become in our actions and social distancing, right? And that in turn affects the metrics. We also make nonlinear decisions, nonlinear policy decisions. So certain states will lock down and it's very difficult to predict when they're going to do that. I'm not saying it's impossible, but what we decided to do was instead of trying to predict the future, we were just going to say what happened, right? Like summarize the past in as best a way as you possibly can. And that to me seemed both more intellectually honest because we weren't trying to we weren't trying to predict the future. We were trying to describe the past. And the second is, even that actually provided value to people, because people don't actually know how things have gone and they don't see the impact of their actions. So what you want to do is be able to say, hey, this state locked down and here's what happened. This state didn't lock down and here's what has happened. And ideally, you don't just do it for states. You can do it for counties, but also you can do it for countries. We just haven't gotten there yet. But what I'll say is, I hope that people look at this as a way to make up their own mind on what is and isn't useful in terms of policy actions, both individually, right? Like, do I go to a birthday party? Do I go to a concert? But then also in aggregate at a government level, does it make sense to allow these types of things? But I don't claim to be an expert in policy and I don't claim to be an epidemiologist. I just claim to be pretty good at summarizing the past with numbers, which I think is not unlike what we did at Instagram. So it's a tool and not the only tool that people use to evaluate where we are.
So one thing that obviously got me quite excited about RT.live is that the underlying model is Bayesian. And before you mentioned that you were reading Bayesian Methods for Hackers, which is a great book, did that come before you decided to use Bayesian statistics for this model? Or was that out of necessity? How did you, in general, I guess, come to Bayesian statistics and then find that it was a good fit for this type of model?
I have always been interested in Bayesian or in statistics. Okay, I'll say that up front. I think one of the biggest mistakes I made in high school was not taking a statistics class, because I thought statistics was a lesser math. Like, it always felt like, oh, like if you're smart, you go take calculus and you go take linear algebra. And statistics is kind of like the easy math. And I couldn't be more wrong, right? If anything, statistics is by far the most useful form of math, in my opinion, applied math, I guess you could say. It shows up in everyday life in terms of uncertainty and making decisions. And of course, if you know linear algebra and you know calculus, it makes advanced statistics a lot easier. But I didn't quite know that at the time. So in college, I studied quantitative finance effectively. That was like effectively my major. And statistics ends up being very important in that, because there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of random variation in asset prices, et cetera. And I always found it super interesting in terms of making decisions. Like, I am very interested in the science of making decisions. So when given two choices, which is the optimal choice? And what's the framework you would use to make that decision? That's a really interesting question for me. And that involves statistics as well. But something about Bayesian statistics or Bayes' rule felt like magic to me. It felt like it was the thing I was looking for in order to really, like, it was like the last puzzle piece in this decision-making framework that I just was talking about. And you might ask why. Okay, if you know what Bayesian statistics is and are, you understand that it's effectively founded on the principle that as you condition upon data, as you learn data, right, as you get new information, you change your beliefs about your hypotheses. That's probably an oversimplification, but just run with me here. It's like, okay, as I start to see more and more clarity in the data about a decision, let's say I'm trying to figure out whether I should take one of a few different routes to get to the airport, right? As you're driving, you might see, there are a bunch of cars backed up in a place that you didn't think they were going to be backed up. Or you see signs for construction that you didn't think that weren't typically there. That type of data can help you inform, but not necessarily make a decision. And how you incorporate that data over time is really difficult if you don't understand Bayesian statistics. So that's how I got into it. How do I incorporate new data as it arises into my decision-making process to guide my beliefs about what the true hypothesis is about a given situation? And honestly, as we started working on RT Live, I just realized, man, I like can't pick just one curve, because there are infinitely many curves of RT that might describe the data that we're seeing. So that felt like a natural fit. Now, going from that feeling or intuition to actually making that happen turned out to be very, very difficult. But we got there. And effectively, the way the algorithm works now is it says, hey, of all the infinite curves of RT that could have existed in the world, which ones are the most compatible with the number of cases that we see every day coming out of every state? And that seems intuitively very basic, right? Like that feels right. Now, if I had framed the question that way initially, I think we would have shortcut a lot of the pain. But that's why Bayesian statistics is so powerful, because it almost seems like an unanswerable question. It's like, of these infinite number of things, which one is the most likely? That seems crazy. But Bayesian statistics allows you to do that. And that's why, being both someone who loves Python and open source, I was naturally inclined to use PyMC3, and R makes no sense to me. So getting your Stan, just like, don't get me wrong, I think Stan's great and their documentation is fantastic as well. But I didn't quite have the chops to figure it out. So I stayed in Python and then found PyMC3 to just be like a great tool to use for the project.
Well, I definitely like the sound of that. So how's that learning experience been like for you in just building the model, also in relation to PyMC3? How happy are you with it?
Well, this is a hard question to answer. Well, it's not a hard question to answer. It's easy to answer, but it's painful, because what I'll say is, I'm not just learning PyMC3, right? I'm also not that great at Bayesian statistics. Like, I needed to really... I learned so much in the last 2 months, where when you and I initially met versus what I'm doing now, it's like, now I'm running custom Theano code. And when we first met, I barely even understood what a likelihood function was, right? So
I'm impressed, actually.
I've come a long way, is what I'll say. So I'm not just learning PyMC3, but I'm also learning the statistics part of this. But then I'm also learning the productionization of this, which is to say, how do you run a pipeline of, say, 50 states all at once, remotely, on something like EC2? So when I say painful, what I mean is, man, like, it's as if you're learning a new sport and you're learning all the skills at once to do that new sport. And you're like getting pretty good at it. Like, you're nowhere near professional, but you're getting pretty good at it, and you're like seeing progress and it feels great. But you look back at your training and you're just like, man, I'm tired. You know, it's like,
that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but what's been really cool, I'll tell you the coolest part. You asked me to just reflect on PyMC3 for a second. What's really cool is being able to go to someone like you or your collaborators and say, hey, there's this thing that clearly doesn't look right. What's going on? And then you guys are able to dig in and realize, oh, we can improve the entire library in this way that not only helps RT Live, but it also helps anyone who wants to build models in any field. That's actually pretty cool. And I think that's been one of the more interesting outcomes of this project, or at least I think so. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Like, this very particular use case and working closely with you on this has led to many improvements in the library on all kinds of levels, and also definitely showcased some of the shortcomings, specifically when it comes to productization. So I think none of us have really productized a PyMC model to that extent that you have, where it's like running every day and then feeding into this website. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in that regard as well. So yeah, it has been very beneficial for the project.
And I guess I'd add to that something that you probably won't say, which is that if you're a beginner and you want to learn this type of modeling, and when I say beginner, it's not like you're totally naive, right? You know something about statistics, but you want to get into this. I find the world of Bayesian statistics and modeling to be very opaque. It's very difficult. Mm. It involves a lot of fancy words like Cholesky decomposition. And you're like, what is that? Like, I have no idea, you know? And then you try to read papers on it, but there's no like Cholesky decomposition for dummies book, right? So what's interesting is it's a bit impenetrable, and I think the one thing that the entire Bayesian statistics community can do, whether it's the Stan community or PyMC3 community, is how do we make this more approachable for more people? Because it's so incredibly powerful. Yet most people don't really get near it because they see these big words and it feels complicated. But after working on it for a couple months, it really starts to click and you're like, oh, I just get how to do this. So my charge would be to the team is like, how do you continue to make this more and more accessible to more people? Because it's such a powerful tool. And if I can do it, I think anyone can do it. It's like, I just had to spend a lot of time to figure it out. But I think that's one of the more hopeful outcomes of this project is taking someone who didn't know anything about this and introducing them to it in a way that helps them learn it and then apply it to an important thing in the world.
Yeah, that is definitely something that I've struggled a lot with, and which is a lot of the motivation for my own blog is making these concepts easy, understandable, and not hiding behind fancy math formulas. Nonetheless, there are these big words which you often need to dispel. And yeah, at the end of the day, there are some nuances where you just don't get around some of the complexity. That is definitely challenging. Yeah. And I think, as you say, there's a lot of unlocked potential in there for these tools, which are powerful, but not all that widely being used to have that impact. Do you have any sense of, combined with all your business experience, what the future could look like for this tool now that you've gotten to know it better?
You mean PyMC3?
PyMC3, or let's say probalistic programming in general. Like, let's say we make it available. And so knowing the type of the business problems that you know, how big could the impact be?
I think the way I'd explain business opportunities is like, it not only needs to be useful, but it also needs to be adopted. Like, the best medicine is the one that someone takes, right? So the problem with Bayesian statistics, I think right now, is that it feels, at least in its current state, so impenetrable. I mean, think about a STAND model where like you have to write in a specific language that isn't quite C, isn't quite R, it's specific to STAND, which I think is fine, compile it, and then run it, and then understand the error messages. And by the way, this is also true in PyMC3 in a certain way, that you kind of have to understand what's going on with the underlying Theano code to debug sometimes. It's so difficult for an average programmer that how do we get it to a place where it can be used by a business analyst? Because I've been reading the book Statistical Rethinking by McElrath, and watching some of the lectures online. And I would highly recommend anyone who wants to do what I did, which is to get into this world of Bayesian statistics, I would start with McElrath's book, honestly. I would start there because I think it gives you a really good intuition of how all these things work. But my point is, in reading it, one of the main points that comes out of it is like, anything you can do in traditional statistics, you can do in Bayesian statistics too, roughly, or better. But it's way more flexible and way more honest. Now, that's a clearly like a Bayesian view of the world. But like, I believe that to be true. And the key, though, is packaging it up in tools where you don't have to write custom Theano functions to do what you want to do, you know?
Right.
And I just think that comes with time and the maturity of a platform. And again, it comes with feedback, right? Like, you have to introduce more and more beginners to it to see where they falter and the types of things that can be useful. The most interesting thing you said before was productionizing this model was an interesting kind of awakening moment for you about either the pros and the cons of PyMC3 in that context. I would say that is true, but I think the even more interesting outcome of this is watching someone who didn't understand PyMC3 try to understand PyMC3, I think helped you guys realize, oh, wow, all this stuff we kind of just took for granted or thought made sense, maybe it doesn't make as much sense. Or maybe we just have to explain it in a different way, or maybe this should be a slightly different default. Or that's been the most fun part of this project for me, is just being the guinea pig for you guys in a way.
Yeah, that has definitely been enlightening in terms of like, how robust are the samples to different starting conditions, and how does someone really learn it? And I mean, this was for us like actually a great success story, because yeah, you really went from basically beginner to building your own models, which are like by now quite complex and solve real problems and deal with real data. So yeah, that has been great to see. So the last thing that I'd like to get your thoughts on is, you obviously spent your whole life with building software, selling software. And I might be wrong, but this working in this open source context might be also a new angle to this. So I'm just be curious, what differences do you see in like the way that open source builds software and also how we collaborate with you, which is more on a voluntary basis compared to being the CEO where probably like the Instagram code was closed and it's very much more traditional software engineering principles.
Totally. So I think there's an optimal interaction pattern for every stage of a project. And I was reflecting on this because when we started working on Instagram stories, we had this enormous team and the project went nowhere. It was like everyone disagreed. Things were being pulled in a million directions and it was a mess. And of course, Instagram stories, if you now look back, was a resounding success. So the question is, how do we go from it being a complete mess to it being a resounding success? Well, we decided it was a mess. And we said, you know what? We're going to pare everything back to like five people. And we're just going to let those five people get a working prototype. And they're going to be shielded from all the bureaucracy of process. And right, it was as if we were applying the wrong machine to the right problem. The wrong machine was the bureaucracy of a large team. The right problem was Instagram stories. So you have to match the tool to the project. And in early stage, I think it tends to be really important to have like maybe a few, one, two, three contributors that just really understand everything. And they just charge ahead really fast. And maybe they raise their hand if they need help on something. But you get kind of the core seed going. And once it reaches what I would call like critical mass, then what's interesting is you can start to set it up to be more, I don't know, say open source, where someone might think of an angle that you haven't thought of, or they might help you get a big part of the project off the ground. But my sense is something, it's very hard to start something from scratch open source. Now, there might be counterexamples, but I think even if you look out and you look at like, I don't know, Linux or something, or even let's talk about Bitcoin, right? Something started with someone individually, I mean, depending on what your theories on Bitcoin are, usually it starts with someone individually coming up with like the core concepts. And then once those core concepts are birthed and put out into the world, then people can start building on it. And I think that's what I've learned in this project too is, you know, initially we had a bunch of people rush at the problem and all of a sudden, you know, we had someone wanting to contribute Russian data and Russian modeling to the US state data, but that US state, the project was really focused on just trying to get off the ground in one place first. And people just felt kind of confused. So now that we have the core, what's interesting is we, you know, our plan is to basically open source this thing very soon. And what will be interesting to see is how people decide to help and improve it over time. And I'm really excited for that because now we have like a core working model for this thing. And I'm sure it will become better once we allow other people to really collaborate on it. That's my reflection on the whole process. But if I were to do it over again, I think any project starts with a core few passionate people. You get it off the ground. And then you unleash the creativity of either a team at a company under the direction of a person or some people, or in the open source community where people self-organize, which I think is a beautiful process as well.
Well, those are fantastic concluding thoughts. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Kevin.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
That's all, folks. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do so on patreon.com/twiki. That's TWIECKI. I would really appreciate it. I also offer consulting services and corporate workshops for PyMC3, as well as an online course to learn Bayesian statistics. If you're interested in any of these, you can find out more on my blog at twiki.io. The intro and outro song is by Joseph McDay and is called On the Verge. Until next time.